This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Alternative Press Review. I'm Randy Gudvangen. This week I'm reading from The Nation magazine. This is the print issue for March 2024. We're going to start with an essay written by Jeet Heer. That's J-E-E-T-H-E-E-R. This is the Morbid Symptoms column. His piece is titled The Gerontocracy. The aging of America's ruling class has radically raised the likelihood of dementia in high places. Aging does strange things to your mind, but then so does political partisanship. In early February, the argument over Joe Biden's age was turbocharged after a report by Special Counsel Robert Hearst characterized him as an elderly man with a poor memory. This provoked the centrist pundit Jonathan Chait into making the bizarre case that senility was not necessarily a disqualifying trait in a president. In a dialogue with a colleague at New York Magazine, Chait said, "Well, if Biden is controlled by advisors, is that unacceptable? If the advisors are making good decisions? Reagan was pretty senile and controlled by advisors. Everybody's forgotten this, but the accounts of his mental state are harrowing. Nobody cared because the results were fine." Not content with invoking Reagan's cognitive impairment, Chait added, "Biden seems more feeble than Reagan." With friends like Chait, Joe Biden hardly needs enemies. The invocation of Ronald Reagan was weirdly unnecessary and self-defeating. There's reason to believe Reagan was suffering from the effects of dementia during the first term of his presidency. Contra Chait, the results were not fine. Someone who purports to be a liberal, as Chait does, should surely remember the attack on the Constitution in what came to be known as the Iran-Contra scandal, the support for genocidal death squads in Central America, and the nuclear brinkmanship that brought the world hair-raisingly close to nuclear war. Fortunately, Biden is not quite Reagan. All evidence suggests that his problems are the result of aging rather than any form of dementia. The same effects are even more pronounced in Biden's slightly younger rival, Donald Trump, who, at age 77, often slurs his words and goes off on long, rambling stream-of-consciousness digressions. Chait's argument should be understood as a kind of preemptive defense. If Biden were to be diagnosed as senile, the situation would still be fine. One wonders if he thinks the same would be true with Trump, who, if controlled by his advisors, extremists like Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon, would surely be even more dangerous. The 25th Amendment, which provides for the removal of an impaired president, does offer a theoretical remedy, although Reagan's presidency suggests that even in dire situations, this solution will be avoided. As ridiculous as it is, Chait's argument at least has the virtue of bringing out into the open a real problem. The emergence of an American gerontocracy that has radically raised the likelihood of dementia in high places. This is true not just of the presidency, but also of Congress, the federal judiciary, and the national security state. In April 2023, the RAND Corporation, a think tank that provides analysis for and receives funding from the Pentagon, released a report that asked, "Could dementia in the national security workforce create a security threat?" The report argues, "People are living longer and working later in life. As a result, the workforce might experience a higher prevalence of dementia than in past generations." These claims need to be qualified slightly. Americans are not, in fact, living longer. Life expectancy peaked in 2014. Modern medicine has created increased longevity, but the benefits are unevenly distributed. As Vox reported in 2018, while poor Americans are dying earlier, the rich are enjoying unprecedented longevity. The news site called attention to research showing that men who were among the top 1% of income earners lived 15 years longer than men at the bottom 1%. For women at the extremes of the income distribution, life expectancy differed by 10 years. Wealthy Americans are now a distinct caste. They live longer and, if they happen to hold political or judicial power, cling on to it as long as they can. Winners in a wildly unfair medical and economic system, they are generally reluctant to share their good fortune with those outside their charmed circle. Gerontocracy and plutocracy go hand in hand. The United States is increasingly a gerontocracy, most visible in recent years in figures such as Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, 82, and Representative Nancy Pelosi, 83, who resigned her position as House Speaker in 2022, but remains a Washington powerhouse. Of the country's 100 senators, 69 are over the age of 60. The RAND study warns that the holders of classified secrets who suffer from dementia might compromise national security. Tactfully, no names are mentioned. Writing in The Intercept, reporter Ken Klippenstein called attention to the high-level security clearances enjoyed by McConnell and the late Senator Dianne Feinstein, both of whom displayed behavior that raised concerns about their cognitive capacity. The RAND study suggests the same might be true of not just lawmakers, but many in the national security establishment. The same problem bedevils the judiciary, where federal judges enjoy lifetime tenure as well as a cozy system that provides an ample number of law clerks to do the brunt of the work. Federal judges are now an average of 69 years old. In 2023, Bloomberg Law reported on several cases of judges behaving erratically, likely because of dementia. As Harvard bioethics professor Francis Shen told the site, "It's really problematic to have a combination of life tenure with no, and I mean zero, check-ins for cognitive ability." Raising the alarm about this issue can be done without ageism. Increased longevity is a blessing, and we should work to make sure it is extended to the poor. It's wonderful that Martin Scorsese, 81, is still directing movies, and that Vivian Gornick, 88, continues to share her wisdom in essays. But in the political realm, where life and death decisions are made and power should be more evenly distributed, a plutocratic gerontocracy that is increasingly prone to dementia is a nightmare, as well as a genuine threat to national survival. That essay was written by Jeet Heer and taken from the March print edition of The Nation magazine. Turning now to the editorial section, this is a comment written by Robert L. Borosage, Borosage, titled Trumpism 2.0. The Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 aims to turn Trump's menace into a governing agenda. What would a second Trump term look like? In Trump's first term, his menace was mitigated by his sloth, his ignorance and incompetence. Don't count on that if he wins in the fall. This time, the right is intent on turning Trumpism into a governing agenda, as illustrated by the Heritage Foundation's multi-million-dollar Project 2025. The project includes four elements: the 900-plus page Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise, which details the right's agenda for each major federal department; the Playbook, a still-secret compilation of initiatives for the first 180 days of a new Trump administration; a right-wing version of LinkedIn designed to recruit thousands of MAGA movement operatives to staff the government, and a presidential administration academy to train them on how to operate. Heritage's proudest moment was its 1980 mandate for leadership, which Ronald Reagan literally distributed to cabinet members. This new effort discards Reaganism for, in the words of the Foundation's new president, Kevin D. Roberts, institutionalizing Trumpism. Project 2025 Associate Director Spencer Chrétien decries the decades of disappointment that occurred because the Republican establishment never moved on from the 1980s. No more supply-side economics, bellicose foreign policy, or belief in small government. Now Trump's fixations will guide the agenda. A first priority will be to bring the permanent bureaucracy to heel. Trump will revive his Schedule F executive order to turn high-level civil service jobs over to political appointees. Instead of the usual 4,000 presidential political appointments, Roberts now suggests aiming for 50,000 or more. These appointees will be guided by a dark, QAnon-inspired vision of America betrayed. Roberts warns that the very moral foundations of our society are in peril, from the totalitarian cult known today as the Great Awakening, which has infiltrated the military, the corporations, the universities, and the bureaucracy. Paul Danz, the director of the 2025 Project, declares that the long march of cultural Marxism through our institutions has come to pass. Our goal is to assemble an army of aligned, vetted, trained, and prepared conservatives to go to work on day one to deconstruct the administrative state. A first priority is deleting the terms sexual orientation and gender identity, or SOGI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, gender, gender equality, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive health, reproductive rights, out of every federal rule, agency regulation, contract, grant regulation, and piece of legislation that exists. The Defense Department would be purged of Marxist indoctrination and divisive critical race theory programs. Any prior involvement in DEI activities, the section on the Treasury Department notes, would be per se grounds for termination of employment. A second target is climate fanaticism, which requires a whole-of-government unwinding. Scientific bodies would be purged and research terminated in national laboratories. The EPA's regulatory powers would be curbed. While dismantling anything climate-related, the next conservative president should go on offense and drill, drill, and drill. America's vast reserves of oil and natural gas are not an environmental problem. They are the lifeblood of economic growth. Millions of undocumented immigrants would be booted out after living here for years or even decades. Military forces would be assigned to the border. A public health emergency would be invoked to shut down asylum requests by people arriving at the border. And the administration would try to end birthright citizenship for babies born on U.S. soil to undocumented parents. China is named as enemy number one. The U.S. military buildup in the South China Sea will accelerate. The trade war escalate. Trump recently called for a tariff exceeding 60% on all goods coming from China. The mandate advocates withdrawing from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the OECD, and the Paris Climate Accord. Efforts to enact a global minimum tax on multinational corporations would be torpedoed. Like Trump, the mandate does little to address the economic interests of working people. No mention of raising the minimum wage or bolstering workers' rights to organize. It recommends 5-year state waivers from labor laws to prove workers would fare just as well without unions. Its risible theory for lifting wages is to limit benefits by putting a lid on the amount corporations can offer tax-free. The priority for Medicare is not lowering costs, but making private plans, Medicare Advantage, the default choice for new retirees. Would a Trump administration have the discipline to impose this agenda? Ominously, beneath Trump's increasingly unhinged stump performances, his team is running a surprisingly professional, well-managed, disciplined presidential campaign, according to one Axios article, a template for governing were he to win. His next administration is likely to be far more organized and destructive than his first. Adam Smith once wrote that there is a great deal of ruin in a nation. We are perilously close to testing that proposition. Well, that absolutely terrifying article was taken from the comment section of The Nation magazine, the March print edition for 2024. We have enough time for, I think, one more comment from the editorial section. This is written by Lyle Jeremy Rubin, R-U-B-I-N, and it is about the recent protester in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. It's titled, Bushnell's Deed. The airman made a conscious decision to self-immolate, and he deserves to be taken at his word. I will leave it to others to discuss the precedents for Aaron Bushnell's self-immolation outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., from Tich Quang Duc to Norman Morrison to Mohammed Bouazizi to Irena Slavina to Wynne Allen Bruce. Yes, this has happened before. The world has been a terrible place for too many, for too long, and for that reason, the rare few who are most inclined to feel that terror, to breathe in its ashes, have found no other option but to set themselves on fire in protest, so that others may be forced to breathe in some of those ashes, too. A debate has erupted about how best to interpret Bushnell's last act. Was it heroic? Pointless? Another opportunity to opine on the need for more robust mental health services? Or to scold those who have dared to take Bushnell at his word? After all, he was anything but inexplicit. Quote, my name is Aaron Bushnell. I am an active duty member of the United States Air Force, and I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I am about to engage in an extreme act of protest, but compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal. End quote. When someone commits an act like this and leaves us with words like that, I feel obligated to take the person at their word, and the words couldn't be more instructive. Bushnell begins his statement with a pertinent self-identification as an active duty member of the United States Air Force. Given the sincerity of his last moments in uniform, it seems he was also announcing his vocation. He was someone who had signed up to sacrifice himself for the greater good, only to discover, as so many of us, myself included, have discovered, that he had signed up for the opposite, to become a willing accomplice to evil. Bushnell doesn't spell out the precise nature of his complicity, but the mere mention of his branch of service suffices. the United States Air Force has played a significant part in Israel's killing spree in Gaza, assisting with intelligence and targeting. It has been helping Israel build its air power for decades now, meaning it has contributed to what the political scientist Robert Pape has called one of the most intense civilian punishment campaigns in history, now sitting comfortably in the top quartile of the most devastating bombing campaigns ever. The airman goes on to call the crime by its name, a genocide, an attempt at destroying a people. Their homes and farms and orchards and entire means of subsistence. Their schools and hospitals and universities, their journalists and professors and teachers and students, the whole of their intelligentsia and their children, so many of their children. An almost instant mass killing of children that is too grotesque even to fathom for more than a second. Their museums and archives and age-old mosques and churches. Hundreds of registered ancient sites, their past and present and future, even their cemeteries, their last and only resting place. Bushnell concedes that his protest is extreme, and yet it pales in comparison to the extremism he is protesting. An extremism not just of everyday death and destruction, but one that qualifies as colonial domination. It is not only that the Israelis, or their patrons, the Americans, determine which Palestinians live or die. It is that they, we, decide how they get to live or die. With or without shelter or food, with or without gainful employment, or a loved one, or the capacity to move across this or that otherwise invisible arbitrary line. It is impossible to convey in a single paragraph the humiliation of having one's bare existence leashed to the whims of an undeserving, self-satisfied master. I enforced a similarly humiliating relationship in Afghanistan almost a decade and a half ago as one of many uniformed humiliators. I'd be remiss if I did not note Bushnell's penultimate sentence on this earth, right before the necessary Free Palestine. He curses our ruling class for making all this normal, all of it. The spoken and the unspoken, the sometimes beautiful and joyful but often needlessly cruel world that's been built in our name. For our purported security, it's a plea to the rest of us, those still living, Bushnell's fellow service members specifically, many of whom entered their service with similar doe eyes, veterans like myself. For good or ill, we enjoy a certain level of credibility on these issues, most don't. And with that, as the cliché goes, comes responsibility. I doubt that Bushnell would have wanted us to follow in his footsteps, at least not by dousing ourselves in accelerant before a sad and enraged farewell. But he no doubt was counting on us, and not just service members or vets, to convey and make use of the sadness and rage in our own ways, in manners that burn and last. Beyond the man-made firestorms in Gaza, beyond the all-encompassing fire. That comment was written by Lyle Jeremy Rubin. He is a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, who writes about capitalism and the United States Empire. We have just a bit of time remaining, enough, I think, for a couple letters from readers. This one is from Dennis Courthoyer from Long Beach, California, titled Plain Speaking. Regarding Stop the War, D.D. Guttenplan makes several important points in his December 11th and it is a December 11th and 18th issue 2023 editorial about the conflict in Gaza. But I'm afraid he still falls into some common traps. Guttenplan writes that the leadership of Hamas remains as committed as ever to its genocidal fantasy that the road to a free Palestine must be paved with the bodies of dead Jews. One need only look at the Hamas Charter of 2017 that superseded its 1988 Charter, which everyone still refers to as if the revised version didn't exist, to see that Hamas harbors no genocidal intent toward Jews, and that its fight is not with Jews, but with a country that occupies the Palestinians' home and oppresses them in myriad ways. Hamas's attack on October 7th was a military action to put Palestinians back in the minds of the world as Israel allies with non-democratic Arab states and descends into fascism. Another trap is the charge of complexity used to try to negate the charges against Israel of ethnic cleansing, genocide, and exile. According to Guttenplan, to label the situation uncomplicated is to betray an ignorance of history. But on a human level, it's very uncomplicated. One group of people established a colony in the land of another, exiled three-fourths of that population, and has treated those who remained not as second-class citizens, the Mirazi he refers to, but as third-class citizens. Allowing Zionists and others to argue that the situation is complicated gives Israel license to deny the many violations it needs to be held accountable for. This is the kind of history and plain speaking that's needed to finally begin to resolve a tragedy that is well over 100 years old. That was the letter written by Dennis Korthoyer. The writer of this letter is an emeritus lecturer in the history department at California State Long Beach and a coordinator of Justice for Palestine, Los Angeles. And finally, one more letter here from Kathleen Tigerman of Steuben, Wisconsin. She writes, regarding the Dems' big chance, John Nichols' editorial in the October 30th and November 6th, 2023 issue urges Democrats to end the profiteering by big pharma, big oil, and big tech to help them win back control of Congress in 2024. Big ag should be added to that list. In Wisconsin, the Department of Natural Resources approved the largest hog CAFO, or concentrated animal feeding operation, in the state. The site is very close to and well above the Kickapoo River, which is considered the heart of the driftless bioregion. This ancient landscape has one of the most valuable resources on Earth, clean water. Pressed by sustainable farmers, grazers, and countless numbers of private citizens who want their drinking water to remain safe to drink, many Wisconsin townships have adopted ordinances to restrain the CAFO's pollution of the water, soil, and air. This is a winning political strategy, especially in rural areas. No one wants hog manure in their water. That, again, from a reader in Steuben, Wisconsin. This brings us now to the close of another edition of Alternative Press Review. I'm Randy Goodwungen. Thank you for tuning in. Goodbye.